And Randy Orton will join the list of great champions and Hall of Famers who have been defeated by Chris Jericho, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, Triple H, Kane, Shawn Michaels, Eddie Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, JBL, The Big Show, Edge, The Undertaker, who I beat twice, might I add. The list goes on and on and on. MVP, CM, Vader 2, Villano 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Juventud Guerrera, Apollo Dantes, Ringo Mendoza Jr., The Great Muda, Masahiro Chono, Funaki, Fuyuki, Jado, Gato, Yoshitatsu, Perry Saturn, Demolenko, Lex Luger, Sting, Ric Flair, Bill Goldberg, Booker T, Stevie Ray, Scott Norton, Buff Bagwell, Flash Flanagan, Flash Funk, Kevin Nash, Diesel, Oz, Scott Hall, Razor Ramon, American Starship.
That right there is why I am going to miss the hell out of Chris Jericho. The best moment on TV all week, bar none. This is Sound Off 128 on sescoops.com. I am the Solomonster here with you for Sunday, October 3rd, 2010. And speaking of Chris Jericho, he's got a DVD you might have heard of that came out this past week called Breaking the Code, Chris Jericho's story, a three-disc DVD set, which is about time because Chris Jericho, for all of his years, going back to 1999, that he's been in WWE, has never been given the DVD treatment. He had a VHS tape made early on in his run, and that was about it. So from what I understand, everything I'm reading, everything I'm seeing online, people are raving about the Jericho DVD. It's got a great documentary, tons of great bonus matches and features, some of which he recorded special commentary for. And it's just a good piece of business. Now, I was looking for the DVD yesterday. I actually went out to Best Buy. And it has been a while since I have shelled out money for a WWE DVD. Not because they're awful. In fact, more often than not, their DVDs are pretty damn good. It's just that I have not had it in me to plunk down $25 or $30. And I know a lot of the DVDs now are probably marked down even cheaper. I don't even have the shelf space anymore for it. So I just haven't seen many of the recent ones. And the Jericho DVD, I was going to make an exception for. And I went to Best Buy, and the price that they had for it in their system, when I asked them to do a search for me because I couldn't find it, they had it listed for $20, which I thought was a steal, and of course they didn't have any in stock. So made my way over to FYE, and they had, you're going to love this, they had the Chris Jericho DVD at FYE, but it was packaged with another WWE pay-per-view. It was a two-DVD combo in which the Jericho DVD was coupled with SummerSlam 2009. Who the fuck is going to buy SummerSlam 2009? Now, it's listed as a free DVD, quote-unquote free, which basically means they're not giving you anything for free out of the goodness of their heart. It means that they couldn't sell all of their inventory for this shitty pay-per-view, and so they decided, shit, we got a lot of crap we got to get rid of here. Let's just package it up with another DVD. That's basically what happened here. Regardless, I have no interest in seeing SummerSlam 2009. I have no room for SummerSlam 2009. And the DVD was available for like $30, and I am not spending $30 on a DVD. I'm sorry, I'm just not going to spend $30 on it. So, didn't buy it. And when I mentioned this later on to a few people, I actually talked to my brother, talked to my mother, and they asked me, "Oh, what DVD were you out looking for?" And I said, "Well, you know, the Chris Jericho DVD." And I was told, "Well, don't buy it." This is what I was told. Don't buy it. Now, of course, for those of you who don't know, I have a birthday coming up this week on Wednesday, and I kind of put two and two together, and needless to say, I'm fairly certain that by midweek, the Chris Jericho DVD will be in my possession. So once I get my hands on it, and I have the opportunity to watch the DVD documentary, I'll do a review on the video here on the Sound Off for all of you who may still be on the fence as far as whether or not you should purchase this Jericho DVD. And speaking of reviews, I also, let's just say I obtained a version of Legendary, the John Cena movie. And I have not yet had an opportunity to watch it, but when I do, if I do, I will have a quick review of Legendary as well here on the podcast. I've had people write in and say, oh, you know, it's really not that bad. It's actually pretty good. It's Cena's best job of acting to date, which it may well be, which still doesn't mean it's good, but I'm willing to keep an open mind. I've heard some good things about this movie, and if I watch it, I will give the thumbs up or the thumbs down on it here on the Sound Off. So I just wanted to get that out of the way first. Hell in a Cell is tonight as I'm recording this on pay-per-view. By the time you listen to it, I'm sure the event will already be over, so it's kind of pointless for me to go into predictions and such. You've got two Hell in a Cell matches. WWE Championship on the line as Randy Orton defends against Sheamus, and Kane defends his World Heavyweight title against the man that he beat clean 1 month. Actually, it wasn't even a month ago. Listen to me. It was 2 fucking weeks ago. At Night of Champions, he beat The Undertaker, and somehow The Undertaker has a world title shot yet again. This time he'll have Paul Bearer in his corner, and that will be for the World Heavyweight Championship. John Cena, one-on-one with Wade Barrett of Nexus. If Cena wins, Nexus must disband, but if Barrett wins, John Cena must join Nexus. Now, there's been a lot of speculation of, you know, is Nexus really going to break up? Is it a spoiler that the next pay-per-view has Nexus all over the poster? Survivor Series, for example, the poster floating around the internet for the pay-per-view is a Nexus poster, which is clearly old because they still have Skip Sheffield and Darren Young in it. Even the Bragging Rights poster has a little Nexus N in the title. Just so you know, all of this means jack shit. So anybody who says, well, because Nexus is in the pay-per-view poster, that means they're going to win, doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. Nexus may well win. In fact, I'm picking Nexus to win this match. I think John Cena will join Nexus, and it'll be a nice little storyline for a couple of weeks where Cena has to conform, you know, to being part of the group, and then ultimately he just says, fuck it, and he probably leaves the group. This is not the Cena heel turn, even if he does join Nexus, just so you know, but just because Nexus is all over the pay-per-view posters coming up doesn't mean anything. Don't let anybody try to convince you of that. These posters are conceived of months in advance, and it just does not mean anything. Natalya and Michelle McCool for the Women's Championship. It also wouldn't be all that surprising if they tacked on one or two matches at the last minute, since the show seems a little short on matches. I know they did some stuff on SmackDown Friday night with Edge and Jack Swagger. That could be a match. You know, I don't know if they would actually do something with Alberto Del Rio and maybe Rey Mysterio, although that would be kind of foolish without any hype, but we'll see. So that's the Hell in a Cell lineup. The only prediction I'll give, I do think that Nexus will win. I hope I'm right, because I think it would be, as bungled as this angle has become, it would be foolish to disband Nexus yet. So I'm pulling for the black and yellow. I want to thank everybody who sent in feedback this past week to last week's special edition of the Sound Off. That was episode 127, my WWE business rundown. I know there were some people who were disappointed by the fact that there was no creative discussion. They thought it was going to be something of a review of potential storylines and things like that. And that's all well and good, except for the fact that I went out of my way to mention that it would not have anything to do with the creative aspect. I believe I said that on this very show last week, and on Twitter and all that, but some people just don't pay attention. So, aside from that, most people were pretty happy with it. Not everybody agreed with it. I didn't expect that everybody would agree. And there'll be some letters in the mailbag later, but some people made some very valid points with respect to bringing in all of that talent and from a fiscal point of view, that it perhaps would be irresponsible to do that without making cuts of another kind. I did not make it clear last week when I rattled off the names of the Ring of Honor guys and the TNA guys that wouldn't necessarily be bringing everybody into the company at once. But we'll get to that feedback from you guys later. I just wanted to thank you up front for the mostly kind words. And if there's any sort of similar idea for a podcast, really, that if there's any sort of subject or topic, I mean, every now and then I'll do a themed podcast. This was really only the second one that I ever did, but if there's any good ideas out there for any future themed editions of the Sound Off, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter or Facebook and let me know, and I may do another one sometime down the road. Now, let's talk a little, let's just start from the beginning of the week here, and we'll kind of run right through. We'll start with Raw. Raw on Monday night was a taped edition. As many of you are aware, they taped two Raw shows last week, back-to-back. The big main event this week was Chris Jericho against Randy Orton. If Jericho wins, he would get a WWE Championship match, and of course, if Orton beat Jericho, as he promised to do, he would rid him from the WWE, which in fact is what happened. Orton gave him the punt of death at the end of that match, and that basically was a way to write Jericho off the show for the foreseeable future. Nobody knows for sure when Jericho's going to be back. The belief was that he'd take a couple of months off and be back early next year. But now Jericho did an interview recently and claimed that he was going to basically just take the next year off to focus on Fozzy. He's got some international tour dates this month, but he also has some scheduled for right around WrestleMania time, which will take him out of the country for another month or so. So it's, you know, it's entirely possible that Jericho won't be around for WrestleMania 27 and will take maybe up to a year off. I find that very hard to believe, but he's done it before, and he knows how to read his body. You know, people have asked him in the past, how have you been able to stay so healthy for most of your career? You know, he suffered a broken arm in I believe, Smoky Mountain early on in his career. But aside from the broken arm, other than the basic bumps and bruises and the pain of being a wrestler, Jericho has been very fortunate in that he has never suffered any sort of serious injury for which he has needed surgery or that has kept him out of the ring for any length of time. And that goes for ECW, WCW, his time in Japan, Mexico, WWE. It's pretty amazing when you compare that to some other main eventers that have come and gone. You know, guys like Triple H and Batista and Edge and other stars, Steve Austin. People have had neck issues, back issues, torn muscles and you know, broken bones and things like that. And Jericho has said, you know, part of it is when he took that 2-year sabbatical, he knew he was burned out, and he knew that if he kept wrestling that way, that increased his likelihood for suffering an injury. So he's very good at knowing when to hold him and when to fold him, so to speak. So hopefully he'll take as much time off as he needs, and he'll come back fresh and start kicking ass again. Because like I said, it was a big, big, big blow to lose Shawn Michaels when he retired earlier this year. In my opinion, Raw has really never been the same. Batista, of course, left as well. And now for Jericho to be gone, and ratings for Raw, which we'll get to in a second, are only going lower and lower, and in large part because of football. I'm sure they'll rebound a bit, but you know, when that's over. But you know, losing Shawn Michaels was tough. Losing Chris Jericho, it's almost like losing a second Shawn Michaels, because they're so similar as performers. They're very versatile. They're great performers in the ring, but you know, Michaels was also great on the mic. He also had a ton of charisma. If he was in a comedy segment, he would carry the comedy segment if they were doing goofy DX stuff, you know. Jericho is an amazing performer in the ring, and he seems to have only gotten better as he's gotten older, but he's also very versatile. You know, he's easily the best, or certainly in the top three, of performers on the mic in WWE. His promo skills are second to none. He can do the serious stuff. He can do comedy. We all know that. And for him to be gone, basically for us as fans, sucks. So I'm sorry to see Jericho go. I was sorry to see him get his head punted off. And that was really the only significant thing of note in the ring on Raw, aside from the plug heard round the world. Now, I must admit, I did not see Raw live. I guess nobody saw Raw live because it was taped. But I was out on Monday night. I went to the movies to go see Wall Street 2, which, by the way, for those of you who have not seen it, I give it a thumbs up. Very good movie. Very nice to see Gordon Gekko back on screen, but I digress. But when I came home and I read up on Raw, everybody was raving, not about a match, not about any particular angle or storyline heading into the pay-per-view, on what was the go-home show to Hell in a Cell. They weren't talking about that. They were talking about Mick fucking Foley. So, of course, I'm scratching my head wondering what the hell's going on here. And much to my not dismay, but much to my surprise, upon watching Raw back on YouTube, there is Michael Cole with Jerry Lawler on commentary as the Great Khali is making his way down to the ring for a match with Sheamus, talking about Mick Foley and his new book, Countdown to Lockdown. A TNA performer whose book alludes to a TNA pay-per-view being plugged on Raw. And there was no snide remarks. There were no backhanded compliments. They said, look, our old friend Mick Foley has a book coming out, Countdown to Lockdown. Want to give him a shout out. He'll talk about this, he'll talk about that, he'll talk about his time as a WWE announcer, and they moved on. And it was amazing. The only thing that would have made it better was for them to put a cover shot on the screen. So, of course, people speculating, what does it all mean? Is Foley coming to WWE? Are they trying to, you know, mend fences since he didn't leave the company under the best of terms? And basically, it just sounds like Vince McMahon wanted to do something nice, as rare as that may be. And he just wanted to give Mick Foley his props and give him some support for his new book. I mean, Vince McMahon was always a fan of Foley's writing. He would tell Foley that all the time, and Mick has talked about that, that Vince was actually the one who urged him to do a third book, his third memoir, which was the Hardcore Diaries, when he was actually brutally honest about certain backstage things in WWE, and a lot of creative team members were not happy when that book came out, but it was Vince who urged him to do it. And so that's the story behind it. You know, Foley is not going back anytime soon, anyway, to WWE or anything like that. And of course, things got even more bizarre later in the week when Joey Styles did an interview with Mick for WWE.com, which is up right now. I linked to it on my Twitter. And it's you know, pretty good interview for what it is. They talk about the book. They talk about some other things. The initials TNA is never mentioned, which is not surprising. And, you know, it's a good interview. And again, more good hype for Foley's book. And Foley has been blown away by all this. He doesn't know what to make of it. But even he has said that, look, it's just he takes it as Vince being nice and showing respect for the hard work that he gave his company all those years. And maybe it is that simple. You know, maybe Vince woke up this week and was in a good mood. They put Foley back on the WWE alumni page on the website after having taken his profile down when he joined TNA, I believe. You may even remember one of the video games years ago when Foley jumped ship. You know, the orders from Vince were that two of the people not to be included in the game were Randy Savage and Mick Foley. So there was definitely bad blood there, and it's good. It's good to see that bad blood seems to have simmered down a little bit. But it was certainly very, very bizarre to hear all of the Mick Foley mentions on TV and then see, you know, seeing an image on WWE.com's main page showing Foley giving the thumbs up, wearing his flannel shirt, plugging his book, was quite bizarre. NXT, I did not see. It is a complete and total waste of time. I don't know why anybody watches the show. I mean, yes, Caitlyn is hot. We know that. You know what? You want to see Caitlyn? Do a Google image search, and you'll find some risque photos of her that are far, far better than anything that you'll see on PG programming on Sci-Fi. Now, this was the last episode of NXT here for us in the United States on Sci-Fi. The show will continue for us online on WWE.com. Of course, nobody will watch. The show is going to still remain on TV internationally, but they just could not find an outlet for it here in the States. And why not? I mean, let's be honest here. For the last couple of weeks, you've had your own announcers go on TV and constantly bash the show. Michael Cole goes out there every week, and Josh Matthews does nothing to disagree with him about the fact that this show is boring, this show sucks, I'm embarrassed to be on the show, and of course, viewers are probably embarrassed to be watching the show. And is it any surprise that no major television network would look at this and go, wow, we got to have this on our station? Of course not. So that's the end of NXT. It's a shame because, again, the concept is generally a good one. They've executed it completely wrong. And I think of all the ideas I mentioned last week as part of Sound Off 127 about how I would do things differently if I were in charge of WWE, that's one of the ideas I really liked the most out of everything was my NXT idea, which, be that as it may, being a ripoff of the UFC Ultimate Fighter concept, is a concept that I think would work and would be effective in getting these younger guys over a lot quicker than WWE normally gets them over. But, you know, whatever. They're free to do whatever they want. That was the final TV edition, like I said. And speaking of Sci-Fi, well, actually, before I get to SmackDown, let me talk about Impact. I actually checked out Impact this week. And I wanted to see the Mick Foley Ric Flair face off. So I figured I'm going to put TNA Impact on. I'll watch as much of it as I can. I got through an hour. So I watched it from the beginning. I saw the Flair Foley stuff. I kept watching. I got to the top of the hour. And I had a tap out at that point. I think it was after the Samoa Joe Mr. Anderson match when Anderson beat him clean with that shitty finishing maneuver that I just said, okay, that's enough. I've had it. I just could not stick around for the cage match at the end, which apparently had a non-finish in a cage match. Yes. Way to go. Anyway, the Flair Foley stuff, since I've been asked about it, my thoughts. Mick Foley, by the way, does himself no favors when he goes out on Twitter for weeks and weeks, because again, this show was taped many weeks ago, and he's been promoting the hell out of it, saying, this was the best interview I've ever done, you guys are going to be blown away, it's the best thing in years, it's the best thing since sliced bread, it's the best thing, blah, 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 blah. And of course, it could not possibly live up to those expectations, and it didn't. It was not the best interview segment I've seen all year. But that does not mean it was bad. I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. Ric Flair, even when he stumbles and mumbles over himself, you could generally understand what he's saying. I thought for sure he was having a heart attack in that ring, and thankfully he did not. Foley, you know, punching himself in the face, and Flair trying to... You see, Flair, it does not take a lot for Flair to make himself bleed. His tissue, his skin is so paper thin that he could literally blade himself without a blade in a moment's notice. And Foley, you know, we've seen this before. There was actually an angle several years ago on Raw, and this might have been leading into the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view in 2006, which had that big tag match where Foley was in it and Terry Funk was in it. And if I remember correctly, they did some stuff on Raw where I think it was Funk, you know, Foley basically had Funk really punch him in the face or something. I know for sure they did something like this with Randy Orton and Foley during their feud many years ago, where Foley basically had told Orton, listen, I want you to really punch me in the face. And Foley, you know, had like a big black eye and his face was all swollen because he told, you know, Orton not to pull his punches. And I can appreciate him wanting to make things more realistic by basically telling somebody, you can really punch me in the face, but I just think it's stupid. I mean, what are you doing that for? You know, what does his wife think when she watches this or when he comes home from work? You know, Foley has beaten his body up enough for us over the years that he doesn't have to do it anymore. So I just thought that whole part of the segment was actually pretty disturbing and pretty uncomfortable. It certainly amped up the intensity. You see these two guys bleeding all over themselves. I mean, if somebody was tuning in for the first time and they see these two guys having an interview segment, and they're probably thinking to themselves, what the fuck just happened here? Why are they bleeding? So yeah, these guys had a bloodbath in a promo, which is something I don't think I could ever honestly say that I've seen before. But the key is they did a more effective job of hyping up a match in advance, I think, than even WWE has done in many, many months. In fact, if you ask me on the spot right now to talk about a WWE match, the last time they did an effective job in promoting a match, I'd probably still have to go back to WrestleMania with the Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match. I thought they did a pretty decent job of hyping up the big tag match at SummerSlam with WWE against Nexus. But they've done such a poor job with Nexus that, it could have been better. I mean, they did a good enough job that I paid money for SummerSlam this year. But, you know, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, I mean, I'm a little biased when I say this, obviously, because I was gonna pay for that match regardless. But they did such an effective job for months hyping that match up, and I can't understand why they can't do that with matches now, but... Kudos to Foley and Flair. I mean, they've only got 1 week now to prep for this thing, but I could tell you that this is not going to be a good match. Anybody expecting to see, you know, work rate in 2010 with Foley and Flair, you're expecting a little too much. It's a last man standing match, and would not surprise me to see Fortune get involved in some way, but I'm anxious to see it. Impact is live next Thursday night. It's there before the Glory special, their go-home show to their Bound for Glory pay-per-view on 10-10-10. So I enjoyed the Foley Flair thing overall. But like I said, I watched the first hour. I could not stomach the second hour of Impact. I did see part of Reaction, and again, Vince Russo popped up on my TV screen for some bizarre unknown reason that I still can't explain. And I watched Russo yak, and then I had to go yak myself. I could not stomach the rest of Reaction out of fear that Vince Russo would pop up again, so I did not watch the rest of the show. I do not want to see Vince Russo. Explain to me why Vince Russo had to be there. I know they're trying to go the more realistic route with Reaction. You never need to have your fucking head writer on your fucking TV show. You just don't have to do it. You know, and again, Russo was on there talking about shit that people don't care about. Who cares about Bash at the Beach 2000 anymore? Who cares? What do I care what Russo thinks of Bischoff? Is Russo going to be on TV as part of the storyline? Because if that's in the plans, I don't even know what to say. Why did he have to be on TV all of a sudden? I don't want to see his face. So that was stupid. SmackDown, big live premiere Friday night on Sci-Fi in Oklahoma City. And again, I was out on Friday night. I was wavering back and forth, you know, it's live SmackDown. Should I stay home and watch it? And then I realized, no, you fucking idiot. It's a Friday night. Let them be punished for the fact that they still kept SmackDown on Fridays when they had the option to move it back to Thursdays, which is what they should have done. They kept it on Fridays, which is still one of the worst nights of the week to have a TV show. So, fuck them. I went out. There was a showing of this indie horror movie called Hatchet 2. Now, many of you have probably never seen Hatchet 1, which I was in that camp as well up until a couple of weeks ago. And I saw the first one, and I actually really enjoyed it. Now, if you're into, like, horror and gore and blood and that kind of stuff, you'll love these movies. It's a slasher flick with the volume turned up like 100%. And the big thing with Hatchet 2 is that for the first time, a major movie chain like AMC here in this country was going to release a movie that had no rating. The movie was all of the violent death scenes and just everything as it was made by the director was going to be uncut in the movie. It was going to be unrated and released into a major movie theater, which you just don't see very often these days. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to go see this movie. There was a Q&A session after the movie with the star of the movie, Danielle Harris. She was actually going to be in the theater doing Q&A with people after it was over. I said, you know what? SmackDown can wait. So I went to the movies. I saw the movie. It was exactly what I expected it to be. It was a lot of fun. So if you're into that sort of thing, it would be another recommendation from myself. Go see Hatchet 2 and support Hatchet 2, because if it does well enough, we may see more movies like this unrated in theaters in the future. But anyway, I wrote about it on my Twitter page. I put a picture up there, too. Danielle Harris was really cool. You might know her. She was on the TV show Roseanne. She was, you know, Darlene's friend, Molly. And she was in the movie Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. She was the daughter and the young daughter. And she's been in a ton of horror movies. She loves doing horror movies. She was in a couple of the Halloween films, Halloween 4 and 5 as a little kid. And the Rob Zombie remakes in recent years, she got a role in those, too. So anyway, that's how I spend my Friday nights. And then I came home and I said, all right, let's find out what happened on SmackDown. And then I did see the show later on, subsequently. Boy, am I glad that I went out on Friday night. I would have been pissed as all hell if I would have stayed home instead of going out to see this movie and see Danielle Harris, if I would have stayed home to watch that shitty show. I thought SmackDown sucked a cock on Friday night. I don't know what I was expecting. I guess because of the hype that it was going to be live, and you know, I just felt like they might have a surprise up their sleeve, perhaps. You know, they had to make a good first impression. They were going to do something big to get people to watch SmackDown on Sci-Fi on their new channel, and nothing happened. I mean, we knew the Raw guys would be there. So what? It was like a second edition of Raw, which hasn't even been that good of late. We had the Nexus. Big deal. We had John Cena. Who cares? We had Undertaker and CM Punk in what was essentially a glorified squash of CM Punk, who was a former 3-time world heavyweight champion. I mean, he got beat clean as a sheet, which shocked the hell out of me. I didn't expect Punk to go over the Undertaker since Taker is in the main event this Sunday, but I figured he would get a little more than he did, or perhaps it would be some sort of no contest at the end, which, you know, in this case, you can excuse a no contest, but nope, clean win for the Undertaker. Punk looks like a jobber. Alberto Del Rio, Rey Mysterio, that was more of a swerve than anything else. We never really got a match between them, which was too bad, really. Because that was one of the points of the show I was kind of looking forward to. Cena and Kane in the main event, Nexus interferes, Undertaker comes back out, and there's a long brawl between Kane and the Undertaker. They battle into the crowd. There's one great moment, the best part of the whole show, in my opinion, where Taker and Kane are battling in the crowd. They're right by one of the staircases, and the fans are right behind them. There's this one idiot in a red shirt who crouches down right behind Kane, and he's saying all these stupid things. And Undertaker went, hit Kane, and Kane fell backwards and knocked the fan over on his ass. And I just thought that was fantastic. So they keep fighting. They brawl back into the ring. And Undertaker finally, unlike Monday night, or rather unlike last week when he went to chokeslam Kane and Kane got away, he did manage to chokeslam his brother, but could not get him for the tombstone. Kane got away, as he should have. They should save that for the pay-per-view. Not that we haven't seen Kane and Undertaker tombstone each other a million fucking times in the last 13 years, but... And that's how SmackDown goes off the air. So, as much as I absolutely love to see Paul Bearer back, I still think it's fantastic to see Undertaker bowing to the urn once again. It would make for a fitting end to his career, by the way, if it was winding down in the next couple of months, which I don't know that it is, but... In any event, this show was not good. And I know some of you liked it, but maybe you were watching a different show than I was, because I was expecting more out of that first live show, the big first SmackDown on Sci-Fi. It just was not a good show. And it certainly didn't do anything for me as far as wanting me to plunk down $45 for the pay-per-view this Sunday. I do not have high hopes for Hell in a Cell. Bragging rights is going to be worse. Bragging rights may well be among the lowest ranking WWE pay-per-view buy rates ever when it's all said and done. Hell in a Cell this Sunday probably won't be too far behind. There's only so much you can do with 2 weeks build. And again, there's no match on this show that makes me go, wow, I got to buy this pay-per-view. SummerSlam, I bought the pay-per-view because of the main event. They got me interested enough to buy that pay-per-view because of the Nexus versus WWE match. Night of Champions had nothing that interested me. Hell in a Cell has nothing that interests me. So, you know, again, I talked about pay-per-views last week and changes that I would make. My changes may not be the best idea in the world. Maybe cutting the number of pay-per-views down from 13 to 7 is not the best idea. But I'll tell you what, I certainly wouldn't have any pay-per-views with 2 weeks build. So... There you go. That was SmackDown this week. Hopefully they'll have better shows lined up in the future. It is a shame. I will cut them a little bit of slack because originally they were going to have the Alberto Del Rio Christian first time ever encounter on SmackDown this week, which had that match happened and had that match been given a solid 10 to 15 minutes of TV time, that would have been a hell of a match. That match alone may have made SmackDown worth watching on Friday night. But of course Christian got hurt, so he's gone and we didn't get that match. Speaking of SummerSlam, the pay-per-view buy rate is in. I don't think it's the final one yet, but the preliminary one. There's been some discrepancies here. I've read a couple of different things. It sounds like the overall buy rate worldwide is 350,000 for SummerSlam, which is down from last year, which was down from the year before that, which was down from the year before that, and so on and so forth. So SummerSlam, over the last couple of years, continues to trend downward. I believe the final domestic number of pay-per-view buys for North America was 206,000, which for SummerSlam is not good. SummerSlam was always different than your typical B show. It was always one of the big four pay-per-views, big five when they brought in King of the Ring. And as much as I hate to say it, SummerSlam has become a B show. Survivor Series has become a B show. The only shows that I really, personally, I look at as A shows are the Royal Rumble because of the Rumble match. It's still a gimmick that I have a fondness for. And, of course, WrestleMania. SummerSlam has truly become a B show pay-per-view. And that is not a good buy rate for SummerSlam. It's better than what Night of Champions will get. It's a hell of a lot better than what Money in the Bank did. But it's still not great. And speaking of not great, Raw... Now, I posted that Raw got a 2.7 rating. You know, when the rating came in and I heard about it, I posted that on Facebook, and everyone was like, no, it was 2.34. That's what Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch said. Well, guess what? Wade Keller was fucking wrong, which is why I don't get my news from Wade Keller. The rating was a 2.74, which, even though not as low as a 2.34, is still pretty fucking bad. The NFL, again, crushed the competition on Monday night. These football games this season so far are pulling in record ratings every single week, which is not only bad news for WWE, it's bad news for everything else on TV that opposes these games. That being said, Raw's ratings when football season starts always go down, but they've never gone this low in the last couple of years anyway. 2.7 for Raw, I mean, these are numbers. These are non-holiday, normal week Raw ratings that... are comparable to numbers they were getting in 1997, before the product really started to turn around and they were in the toilet. People obviously don't really care much about the fact that Randy Orton is the champion. And for everybody saying, well, Randy Orton's just like Stone Cold Steve Austin, Randy Orton ain't got shit on Stone Cold Steve Austin. When Austin held the belt, numbers went up. Unfortunately, I don't know that it's an indictment of Orton so much as it's just a different day and age. And there is not one star that is bigger than the company. Everybody is kind of on the same level. Randy Orton may get more cheers than everybody else, but everybody is essentially on the same level. You can't point to that one guy that's truly larger than life, like Austin at his peak, or The Rock, or Hogan at his peak. That's what they're missing. And, you know, if they could find somebody like that, maybe their fortunes would turn around a little bit as far as these ratings are concerned. But yeah, not a good sign for Raw, especially on the go-home show heading into a pay-per-view. A couple of other quick notes here. Tyler Black, the former Ring of Honor champion, who is down in Florida Championship Wrestling now for WWE, has in fact gotten his big name change. Originally, I think he was, or there's a report that said he was being called Zach Rollins, and I'm not sure if that was just an inaccurate report, or if in fact I was correct when I said to somebody on Facebook that that name would be changed very quickly, because Vince McMahon would not allow two Zachs on his roster, and sure as shit, his official new name is Seth Rollins. So there you go. Tyler Black, now Seth Rollins, down in FCW. To be honest with you, I don't think it's a bad name. I will accept that name perfectly fine compared to what it could have been. Okay, when I think of names like Eli Cottonwood and Husky Harris, which has actually grown on me, I must admit, and he should be on TV right now, but Seth Rollins is not a horrible name. Daniel Bryan, as much as I still hate that stupid name, because why can't they just call him Bryan Danielson? It's close enough to his real name where I can, again, I can accept it. These are actually names I would put in the good category when you compare to Percy Watson and Lucky Cannon and, oh God, I mean, just, anyway. I want to give a quick shout-out to my good buddy Amish Cousin Simon, him and his partner Cyrus, the Mighty Mennonites. Mennonites? Mennonites. I did say that right. Anyway, the Irish boys. The Amish boys. Jesus. They are not Irish. They are Amish. Anyway, they were victorious last night at the WUW event at Gleason's Gym in Brooklyn, New York. And they are on their way. They are well on their way, in my opinion, to tag team gold. I predict that before long they will be tag team champions, and when they do, we'll try to get them on the show at some point. So congrats to my buddy Pete on his big win last night. All right, so let's get some business out of the way here. There was a correction. Let me just bring up the mailbag here, because there were some people who wrote in to correct something that was mentioned in the mailbag 2 weeks ago, and I don't think I mentioned it last week. It was regarding Primo Colon having never been a champion. I was wrong when I said that. In fact, Primo and Carlito were indeed WWE Tag Team Champions. They won the belts on September 26th, 2008, from Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder, and then lost it the following June to Edge and Chris Jericho. That must have been just before Edge went down with his Achilles injury, and then we got Jericho when Big Show replaced him. So Primo was, in fact, a former tag champion, so I apologize for that error. And the other thing was, somebody had written in to mention Michael Cole, alluding to the fact that he was once in a tag team championship match, and I could not for the life of me figure out when this match had taken place, even though I'm sure I saw it, but things happen so often every week on Raw that I can barely remember what happened on the show last week, which is, again, is amazing when you think about it, because I can probably, if you ask me a question about a WWE show, like a pay-per-view or something from like 1990, even like an undercard match, 9 times out of 10, I could probably tell you exactly what happened, but I can't remember what happened on Raw 2 weeks ago. But anyway, a couple of people wrote in with the answer, including Chris. Chris wrote in to mention the fact that it was on July 28th, 2008, on Monday Night Raw, Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase were the tag team champions, and this actually was the night that the new general manager of Raw was revealed to be Mike Adamly. And before Adamly revealed himself at the end of the show to be the GM, the up to that point anonymous GM changed a match that night. It was supposed to be Jerry Lawler and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, the Legends, going up against Legacy, or Priceless, I guess, as they were called at the time, for the tag team titles. And at the last minute, the GM changed the match, took Jim Duggan out, and replaced him as Jerry Lawler's partner with Michael Cole. So we had no commentary for the match. Cole was up on the apron. He didn't really do much, except in the finish he factored into, because he was tagged in, and he was in there with Cody Rhodes, and he punched him in the face. And the finish basically was Cody Rhodes just kind of clotheslined Michael Cole very clumsily down to the mat and pinned him 1-2-3. So, yeah, there you go. That was Michael Cole's Tag Team Championship match from 2008 on Monday Night Raw. So let's get into the mailbag for this week. And let me preface this by saying it is my favorite month of the year. It is October, which means it is Halloween month. And I want you to write in with your scariest wrestling moments that you can remember. Any, and that can mean any number of things. It could be a scary character that made his debut. It could be some sort of special Halloween moment from you know, a WWE show or a WCW show or ECW or whatever. It could be a scary bump that somebody took or anything like that. Your scariest wrestling moment, write into me. Share them with the Solemn Monster, and I'll share them with the rest of you on the Sound Off next week. Dylan writes into the Sound Off, "Dear Solemn Monster, I'm a big fan of the podcast and want to know the story on Muhammad Hassan and why he was released from WWE back in 2005. What were your thoughts on the character and the heat that he was picking up with the crowd?" Well, the Muhammad Hassan character was definitely a heat magnet. And Vince McMahon had big plans for Hassan. That was back in 05. And at one point, Hassan was penciled in to beat Batista for the World Championship at SummerSlam. They were really going to go all the way with the character. You know, similar to what they did with Sergeant Slaughter back in 91 when they put the world title on him before they transitioned the belt back over to Hulk Hogan. I was not the biggest fan of the character when it first debuted. Obviously, they were playing off ridiculous 9/11 stereotypes. WWE has no shame in doing these things, although I think they're a little more sensitive to it now with Linda running for the Senate and the whole PG direction. But for years and years and years, I mean, jingoism and things like that were, or you know, xenophobia, all those things were very big with Vince McMahon and WWE, and they still are. But it worked over time. I mean, the character was getting the heat that they were hoping it would get, even though if it was in bad taste. Basically what happened, it was a combination of different things. The main thing that happened was, at the time, SmackDown on UPN, there was a lot of heat on WWE for something that happened on an episode of SmackDown, where Hassan was feuding with The Undertaker. And after, I think it might have been after a match that The Undertaker had or something, these hooded guys that were clearly made to resemble terrorists, like Al-Qaeda terrorists, came out to the ring and beat the piss out of The Undertaker. And this is the way the whole thing was done. It was just stupid. It was classless. It really was in poor, poor taste. And the network was not very happy about that. And the network wanted Hassan off the show. They did not want that character on TV anymore. That really is what killed the Muhammad Hassan character. WWE was pressured into getting rid of it. Mark Copani, who was the person playing the character, who in real life is just an Italian guy, never really had his heart into the character or into wrestling, people have said. And he always had aspirations of becoming an actor, of moving out to Hollywood and doing some acting, which is exactly what he did. I don't think he's been terribly successful at it, but when he left wrestling completely. And he went to Hollywood and tried to become an actor. And I believe he's involved in some other venture. I don't know if it was something with a comic book or something. I don't know. But in any event, he's not doing any wrestling to the best of my knowledge. He might be doing some conventions now and then. But, yeah, he just never really had his heart into it. He never had the passion that other people had. And the network essentially killed the character. So that's what happened with Muhammad Hassan. Greg from Wyoming writes in, "Dear Solemn Monster, over the last few years, there have been a number of wrestler deaths, some of which were under contract to WWE when they died. Owen Hart and Eddie Guerrero, for example. And some that weren't, like Test and Lance Cade. While I'm not saying that everybody that has ever been in WWE should be inducted into the Hall of Fame, I wonder why a lot of those guys have not been, like Owen Hart and Eddie Guerrero. What are your thoughts on this?" Well, first of all, as I pointed out to Greg in my email back to him, because I did respond to a lot of feedback directly this week, Eddie Guerrero is already in the WWE Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 2006, just a couple of months after he passed away. Owen Hart not being there has more to do with his wife not wanting him in there. WWE has got to be sensitive in handling this, especially with Linda running for office and all the Martha Hart stuff that kind of blew up a couple of months ago. They don't want to come off as cold, you know, publicly anyway. Now, that being said, Owen Hart deserves, in my opinion, to go into the Hall of Fame. I mean, if they could put Nikolai Volkoff in there, then believe me, Owen Hart deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Nikolai Volkoff never main evented a WWE pay-per-view a day in his life. Owen Hart did, and he held numerous championships. He was a tremendous performer. He was there for many, many years. He did many, many different angles, you know, teamed up with a lot of different people. He's part of a lot of different factions. He deserves to go in the Hall of Fame, and I believe at some point down the road he will. Keep in mind that WWE does not want to induct more than one or two deceased wrestlers per year. So others will get in before him. It just may take a long time. Now, you know, Greg did not name any other wrestlers who have died recently who, in my opinion, are deserving of a Hall of Fame induction. You know, Test, Lance Cade, and Umaga, with all due respect, do not belong in the WWE Hall of Fame. Now, Umaga, you could potentially make a case for. You know, he was the Intercontinental Champion. He was handpicked to be part of what turned out to be the biggest money match in WWE history at WrestleMania 23. But I don't think that's a Hall of Fame-worthy credential because it had nothing to do with Umaga. Just like Bobby Lashley. You know, it had nothing to do with Bobby Lashley. Those two guys, you could have put anybody in those slots. You could have put me in that slot. You could have put me and Noah Mark in that match at WrestleMania with Vince and Trump's hair on the line. And the match still would have... All right, well, maybe it wouldn't have done that well. But you get my point. I don't think any of those guys, again, with all due respect, are they just don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Test, Lance Cade, Umaga, you know, why? Why would they be in the Hall of Fame? You know, so anyway, I just wanted to point out the fact that Eddie Guerrero is in fact in the Hall of Fame, which Greg seems to have forgotten. Got an email here from Rob. Dear Solomonster, you mentioned in your last podcast that titles in WWE don't mean anything anymore because they change hands so frequently and they are not given any prestige as a result. Bret Hart mentioned in an interview that back in the days of Hulkamania, holding the heavyweight title not only meant being the champion and flag bearer for the company, but also meant being the highest paid guy in the company. Since belts change hands so frequently these days, do you know if that practice is still true today? Does holding either heavyweight title carry any monetary benefits? Do any of the other titles have any monetary benefits attached to them as well? The other belts do not. The main belts mostly do not. Becoming a champion in WWE does not hold the same monetary benefits that it did in the old days. You don't get a pay raise out of it. You don't get a you don't put a deposit down on the title like they did in the old days of the NWA. The only potential benefit that would come from greater exposure, because if you're a world champion, you're going to be on TV every week. In that case, it guarantees you a spot on pay-per-view shows, and so with that, you get a cut of the pay-per-view money. That would be the only monetary benefit I could think of in 2010 in terms of WWE or TNA that would come out of being a champion. It definitely does not mean what it did in the old days. Got a letter here from Mario from Egypt. Been a fan since episode 100. Got a question that was in my head, Solomonster, for a long time. We all know that Shawn Michaels' finishing move, Sweet Chin Music, has finished off many wrestlers. You know, once he kicks them, they go down and they are done. My question is, why when Shawn Michaels was tag partner as part of DX with Triple H or with John Cena, why did he finish a lot of the guys with the super kick, but they never fell? Instead, they just turned around and got pedigreed or FU'd by Michael's partner. Isn't this killing the move or making it seem a lot weaker? I agree wholeheartedly. It makes the move look weak. More importantly, it emphasizes how fake it all really is. This really bugged me when Steve Austin and The Rock would get together. I mean, if you remember the end of the 1998 Royal Rumble, you know, Austin gave Rock a stunner, and instead of falling down and selling it, Rock just pops right back up, and he starts flailing around, and he waits for Austin to grab him and throw him over the top rope. The same thing, they had a match, this was after their WrestleMania match in 99, it was at Backlash, and Austin gives Rock a stunner at the end of the match, and instead of going down, the Rock just pops right back up, just so Austin can follow up with a belt shot that ultimately knocks out the Rock. Well, why did you use the stunner in the first place if you weren't going to take the guy out with the move? It just, yeah, I'm even amazed a guy like Steve Austin, who was pretty, you know, anal about stuff like that, would allow something like that, because in my opinion, it just makes the move look weak, and again, it makes everything look more fake than it really is. So I agree. It's one of those little things that not everybody picks up on, but I'm with you. It's annoying, but what the hell are you going to do? Nathan writes into the podcast, "Dear Solo Monster, love last week's sound off. It made the most wrestling sense I've heard in years. I don't even watch wrestling anymore because I feel the product has become stagnant and repetitive, though I do still keep a high wrestling interest through DVDs, SE Scoops, and of course the Solo Monster." Well, thank you for that. On to my question regarding pay-per-views. I think the best number of shows to have each year is 8, keeping the big 4 and having one small one in between, and I'd bring King of the Ring in place of Survivor Series. Makes sense to me, seeming that WWE wants to get rid of the whole pay-per-view anyway. Also, apart from TNA and Ring of Honor, if there was another promotion to spring up overnight in America or the world to rival WWE, who would it be? Well, let me answer the second question first. I don't think I understand your question. If you're asking whether or not there exists another company right now aside from TNA and ROH that could be competitive with WWE, they don't exist. I mean, you have this potential new Florida promotion, which is all pie in the sky until they actually start doing business. If you're asking me who could spring up out of the ground and rival WWE, how could I possibly answer that? As for your first question, well, you know, you can have 8 pay-per-views instead of the 7 that I suggested last week. I'm not quite sure where number 8 would fit in, given that it would make things a bit lopsided. Which is why I suggested 7 in the first place. The big 4 plus King of the Ring in June, and then 2 others to fill the gap. So you usually will end up with a good 6 weeks between pay-per-views. I would not get rid of Survivor Series. I think adding War Games to it is money. So that's how I would handle that. The Bowling God, or so he says, writes into the podcast, "Why would WWE plug Mick Foley's new book? And did he say Friday will be a cold day in Mick Foley's life? Was it referring to Friday as the release date? If so, do you think there may be a future lawsuit coming about stuff in the book?" Well, as I said earlier, I mean, they plugged Foley's book. Vince did it as a kind gesture to him. He also did it, I should mention this because I didn't say it earlier, but Foley has went out of his way to defend Linda McMahon from these media assaults on her campaign. And Foley is a registered Democrat. It's not like he'd be voting typically for somebody like Linda in an election. And I don't even think he's a registered voter in the state of Connecticut anyway. Foley, he actually did a big column on it, actually. I think it was, I don't know if it was on the TNA website or on his TypePad blog, but a couple weeks ago, Foley did one long article regarding Linda McMahon in support of Linda. That may have also had something to do with this in terms of his supporting Vince's wife. But again, on Raw, there were no derogatory remarks. You know, they did not say that Friday will be a cold day in Mick Foley's life. I believe they said Friday will be a good day or a big day in Mick Foley's life. And yes, that was the release date for the book, Countdown to Lockdown. It is available now in bookstores everywhere. See, I can get Foley a good cheap book plug myself. As far as future lawsuit, I'm not sure where you're pulling that from. I mean, apparently out of your rectum, because I don't believe there's anything overly derogatory in the book about WWE at all. Foley has said that he did not put this book together to trash anybody. Even his days, as challenging as they were as an announcer, and we know that Vince would yell in his ear and stuff like that, I don't think he actually dishes any specific things that Vince were saying to him. He doesn't bash Vince McMahon. So what could they possibly sue him for? And why would they plug the book if they were planning on suing him for something he wrote in the book? It doesn't make any sense. James writes in, "Dear Solo Monster, I've been listening since episode 10. I'd like to see Bite This return, as you said last week. I'd like to see Bite This return the same day that you take over as the czar of WWE. I remember a weekly Saturday night show that they put on about 7 years ago or so that was hosted by Jonathan Coachman and Trish Stratus. Was that show also Bite This, or was that something else?" Well, you're thinking of, it was a TV show. It was not Bite This. It was a show that aired on TNN, which of course is now Spike TV, called Excess. And they would sometimes have wrestlers as guests in the studio, as they did once with Shawn Michaels, which was actually many months before he officially came back to WWE. They had him on set to kind of co-host the show with the coach and Trish Stratus. So, yeah, that's the show you're thinking of. It was one of the many studio shows that WWE has had over the years. Mike writes into the podcast, "Your Solomonster, great show this week. I appreciate the effort put into it. I agree with you on everything, especially the WWE hosting pre- and post-shows during pay-per-views. Regards, all the way from India, Mike." Well, thank you, Mike. That and the NXT idea were the two ideas that I was most excited about. And somebody else sent me an email, and they pointed out that many years ago, it was after the 1996 Royal Rumble, the pay-per-view went off the air, and they had this thing called... And they did this actually for a couple of the In Your House things. They had something called, let's say it was called In Your House. It was called In Your House Extra. That is similar to the idea that I had last week, although I had completely forgotten that they even did that. My idea is more of a studio type thing, almost takes on like a sports feel, in that you have a set where the announcers are sitting there live. They do like an analysis. They do an interview with somebody. They show a replay of a big angle that happened. That was something that was used to fill the final 2 or 3 minutes of pay-per-view time that they had, and they usually did an interview backstage with somebody. Even something like that is perfectly acceptable. Just something. Dangle a little carrot in front of us to give us a little something extra at the end of these pay-per-views. Shane writes into the podcast, "Do you think that Shane McMahon could have been world champion because if he would have trained better back in the day?" No, I don't. I really hope this was not Shane McMahon asking this question. Got two questions here from Tony. Number one, why did Jim Cornette leave WWE, and do you think we'll ever see him back there, whether backstage as a booker or on camera? Cornette was phased out as a TV character in the late 90s. He was doing commentary on certain shows, too, to work more in a backstage capacity for WWE before he was transitioned into their developmental system in OVW. He was fired by the company several years later. That was after an incident where he physically abused Santino Marella at one of their shows when he was down in developmental. As far as Cornette being back, never say never in the wrestling business, but if there was ever a case where I would say never, this would be it. There's, you know, he still harbors a great deal of ill will towards WWE and has said himself that he will never ever go back to work there. So I would say probably not. The second question here from Tony. "For the first time, I watched the Monday Night War DVD and was, in watching it, TNA came to mind because it seems like a lot of the things that they're doing was already done in WCW. Am I being naive to think that?" You are not naive at all. I talk about this all the time. TNA is making many of the same mistakes WCW made, and they're employing the same people who helped sink the Titanic. They've got Russo, they've got Bischoff, they've got Hogan, they've got Nash. And they've got a whole bunch of other names, too, although it's not necessarily their fault for WCW's demise. But, yeah, same mistake, same people in power. Whatever happens to them, they get exactly what they deserve. I mean, I hope for the best, but whatever happens to them, fate will work itself out. It just has a tendency to do that. The pieces will fall where they belong. Artie writes into the podcast with some words regarding one Matthew Hardy, who I'm very happy I did not mention his name until 57 minutes into the show. I think Artie has a great take on things here, and I'm going to let him speak and say what he needs to say. "Dear Solomonster, I know you said that you would not waste precious time on the latest ramblings from Madman Matt Hardy, but with all of his YouTube entries and cryptic tweets, I just want to rant and ask, who the fuck does Matt Hardy think he is? I think Jake the Snake Roberts said it best on his DVD in regards to not having a run with the WWE title, in that it was not his role to be champion. His role was to essentially prepare wrestlers for future programs with the champion. By whining, Matt Hardy, you are not only pissing on whatever legacy you created in WWE, but you're also saying that you were more deserving of a title run than wrestling greats who never were world champion, including the Million Dollar Man, Jake Roberts, Mr. Perfect, and Owen Hart. So do us all a favor, and I want you to take your gun, your giant sword from your latest YouTube entry, and a la The Rock, turn those some bitches sideways and stick them where the sun don't shine. In other words, know your role and please shut the fuck up. Thank you once again, Solomonster, Artie from Los Angeles." Well, thank you, Artie. I could not have said that better myself. Josh writes in, "Dear Solomonster, in listening to some interviews, it seems there is a dress code for WWE performers. I've heard specifically of a confrontation between CM Punk and The Undertaker. Do you know what the dress code is and how that sort of thing is handled by WWE?" There has been a dress code in place now for several years. And basically, you have to be wearing a... I don't know how it works for female performers, but I know that if you're a male performer, with few exceptions, John Cena may be one exception to the rule. You know, he does wear a suit when he does certain media appearances, but I think generally backstage, Cena, I think, is allowed to wear his usual John Cena attire. But I know the guys have to wear suits. It's just something that, you know, and a lot of companies have dress codes. So it's just a way to make the performers look more professional when they're out and about in public. And as far as the reported confrontation involving Punk and The Undertaker, it wasn't so much a confrontation, but the story at the time, and this would have been earlier this year, was on a European tour. And, I think Punk maybe was not dressed the way that he should have been on the road. And Undertaker noticed this and, you know, perhaps took umbrage to this after having discussed it already with Punk. And it was pretty much a non-issue after that. There was no physical confrontation between the two of them. I mean, CM Punk would have to be the biggest fool in the world to either instigate or participate in any sort of physical confrontation with The Undertaker, of all people. Niels writes into the podcast, I know you've spoken about this before. What drives WWE to change the existing names of performers into odd ones? Tyler Black into Seth Rollins, or names like Husky Harris, or even ludicrous ones like Michael McGillicuddy? WWE does realize that, labeling your superstars with idiotic names generally limits their chances quite a bit. Guys who keep their real names, for instance, John Cena, Randy Orton, Kurt Angle. Does Vince McMahon choose these names? How does the naming process come about? If you could shed any light on this matter, then by all means, please do. Vince McMahon has, in certain instances, recommended names or suggested names for people, but by and large, it's not Vince McMahon who sits there and comes up with these shit names. It's a combination of different things. It could be the agents in FCW, but I think the creative team in WWE, they have a lot of input into that. And I remember that because when Ken Doan was renamed Kenny Dykstra before the Spirit Squad came about, there was some talk about how, well, you know, the a creative team must have a Lenny Dykstra fan on their roster. Lenny Dykstra, of course, was a famous baseball player. He played for the New York Mets when they won the World Series, and he played for the Philadelphia Phillies, and now he's a fucking criminal. But in any event, I think the creative team actually has the biggest say in that matter. But it's not Vince McMahon necessarily. He does not sit there and come up with names for all of the developmental talent. I think creative is responsible for that. And it's true, I've talked about this before, that one guy being saddled with a really, really shitty name, it's like wearing the scarlet letter A for the rest of your career. You know, it brands you in a bad way before you even have a chance to develop. And that's what I was worried about with Dolph Ziggler. You know, and I know that Dolph is the Intercontinental Champion right now, but I just cannot envision Dolph fucking Ziggler with that name being a World Heavyweight Champion one day. I just can't do it. You know, they could cut the last name off. They've done that with people before. And just call him Dolph. You know, remember when Rikishi came into WWE, he was originally Rikishi Fatu, and eventually they just started calling him Rikishi. So that could be one saving grace for Mr. Ziggler if he ever makes his way into the main event picture. But it's a terrible thing. And it's the reason they do it largely is so that they can own the name. You know, for merchandising and things like that, it's hard if the person uses their real name. And, you know, why certain people are allowed to and not others, I'm not quite sure. Why CM Punk? Of course, CM Punk is not his real name, but that was the name that he came up with and used on the independents before he came to WWE. He was allowed to keep his name. I think Paul Heyman had something to do with that. Excuse me. But why certain people are allowed to kind of slip by, that I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And last question here comes from Emin Rogers from Belfast, Ireland. Your Solomonster. Don't really have a question this week, more of a request, some wise words. Big fan of the show. Recently, I've been given the opportunity to do a weekly show for a radio station here in Ireland on any subject I wanted. So I pitched the idea of doing a professional wrestling radio show. It'll be 1 hour every week with the chance to go to 2 hours and live if everything goes according to plan. Just want to know if you had any advice on how I can make this show a real success and hopefully move on to bigger and better things. Thanks for reading. Well, first of all, congratulations on your show. And really, the best advice I can give you, it's nothing specific as far as, you know, a technique or anything like that. The best advice I can give you is just to be yourself. Don't be, you know, don't try to be something that you're not. Be as honest as you can possibly be. If your show is taking on more of an opinion format, then give your opinion. And, you know, when you're dealing with radio, you probably have to stay within certain language parameters, which thankfully is something I don't have to worry about. But just be yourself and always stay on top of the subject matter. If you're doing a pro wrestling show, know what's going on. If you're going to do a radio show talking about WWE and TNA, know what's going on for the most part in WWE and TNA. And it always helps to have a little bit of Solid Monster on your show. So if you have some sort of toll-free line, I'd be more than happy to give a call and call in and answer some questions and show some support on your show. And that goes for anybody, by the way, with a radio show. I actually had called into a radio show on WRMU in Ohio. My friend went to college there. This is going back about 8 years now. And he actually had me call into his show to do a weekly wrestling wrap-up report. It wasn't a wrestling show per se, but he wanted to have some wrestling discussion in it. And I was more than happy to call up and help out with that. So anyway, that's my advice. Just be yourself. Know what you're talking about. Know the subject matter. Don't be nervous. You'll get used to it over time. And and good luck. And let me know how that turns out. So if anybody out there has a show of their own in terms of a radio, I'm not going to start plugging podcasts and all that, but definitely let me know about that. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to thesolomonster@gmail.com. You could follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solomonster and send me your Halloween costume suggestions, because I am just racking my brain trying to figure out what I'm going to be this year. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolomonster. And, of course, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It's free. It does not cost you any money, you freeloaders. And, so that's about it. Episode 128 in the books. Yeah, I promised I would keep it a lighter load this week compared to last week's two-hour sound-off. We're clocking in at a little over 60 minutes this week, which is good. And we'll be right back here, as always, next weekend with episode 129, as this Halloween month rolls on. Remember, email me your scariest wrestling Halloween moments or scariest wrestling moments in general. And in the weeks to come, I will share them right here on the podcast. So until next time, be well, stay safe. You've been listening to The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.